One, I should note that Justice Wright will not be participating on any of today's cases. And with that in mind, our first case of the day is State versus Keon D. Hill. Mr. Pivovar, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, and please record I am court-appointed counsel. I stand here in an enviable position today. I participated in neither the trial of this man nor the briefing. I was appointed for all. As such, last week I filed a motion to release the case after having met with my client, after going through what was this pretty extensive record, about 1,800 pages about 400 exhibits, and then dealing with it. As court's well aware, I'm here because prior counsel was stricken, prior appellate counsel was stricken with stroke.
And Mr. Pivovar, if you, at the end of today's arguments, if you wish to file another, if you wish to make another motion to submit further briefing, you may do that.
Okay. Well, I was going to make that at the start, but if...
You can make it at the start if you wish.
Okay. Well, I was prepared to argue that briefly, and you know, in light of the case law that says that arguments have to be specifically assigned and specifically argued, in discussing this matter with my client and going through the brief, there are two arguments in this brief that are specifically argued to some extent, the first two arguments. The last three arguments, I don't believe there was more than a half a page on any of those arguments. And to me, and in meeting with my client, they were the more substantial arguments in the case: insufficiency of evidence, ineffective assistance of counsel, and prosecutorial misconduct.
So is this a motion that you want to add something to your brief?
I would move to be allowed, at least after argument, to rebrief specifically those three arguments. And specifically, the ineffective assistance of counsel. I spent a long time on this case, and I would hate to be foreclosed from participating in what I am sure is going to be a post-conviction action by Mr. Hill against trial counsel based upon what he's told me, and then would have to be against appellate counsel, who I would be by nature of arguing this case.
You can have 10 days to supplement your arguments.
I appreciate that, Judge. The first argument that was set out in the brief was the motion to suppress argument. On the morning of December 10th, there was a white Taurus seen in the neighborhood of the Spencer Project. That white Taurus was moving at a very slow rate. There was a task force there from the Metro Area Task Force looking for a fugitive named Charles Tolles. Charles was being sought on federal charges. This was about 7 o'clock in the morning, then on December 10th. Pretty dark at that time of day. I think there was testimony dark. The task force members say they identify a woman driving the vehicle and a black male in the passenger seat. They make what appears to be a conscious decision to pull that vehicle over. Two black SUVs pull in behind that vehicle. those are unmarked vehicles, black SUVs, presumably tinted windows. I'm not sure that came out in the record. At 7 o'clock in the morning, following a slow-moving car slowly. That car then speeds up and does what the one officer describes as a curb jumping, I believe, curb bumping, trying to get away. They observe what they describe as a California stop at one stop sign. They then activate, put their lights on top of their cars, activate their lights, and go after that.
And you would understand a California stop not to be a stop within the meaning of our traffic laws?
I think it was clarified in the record, Justice, and it was indicated that it was not a complete stop.
It was not a Nebraska stop.
Perfect. Perfect. We created a new idiom today. After the California stop, they did pull over. As more cars got there, the passenger jumped out of the passenger seat and put his arms in the air. At that point, the federal agent who was heading the apprehension of this particular individual, not this particular individual, but Charles Tolles, who they were looking for, says, that's not him. That federal agent very quickly exits the scene. At that time, because probably of the passenger getting out of the car, the other officers that are still there decide to approach. They do. They approach the driver. The driver is a black female. And one of the officers indicates that he was very nervous, so I thought I would further inquire. He continues to further inquire. At some point, he asks her for permission to search. This is not her vehicle, but her mother's vehicle, I believe, according to her. At first, he asks her, is there anything in the car that shouldn't be in? And she says, at that point, he asked for permission to search. She grants permission to search. Now, there's some other stuff in the record by one of the officers that he saw the gun sticking out. Well, if you viewed the photographs in this case, there's no way that gun was sticking out because the officer that pulled the gun said she took pictures of the gun exactly where it was. It was deeply tucked under the passenger seat. There was also controverted testimony by the main officer, Officer Gassaway, that he had seen the defendant make a furtive motion like he was tucking something under the seat. This gun is then confiscated. Mr. Hill is arrested. DNA is run on that gun, and it turns out that Mr. Hill's DNA is on it. Maybe consistent with having tucked it in the seat, I don't know. Consistent with having possessed it at some time. I'm sorry, we're dealing with February 12th. I'm sorry. December 10th was the date of the incident. It's tied to a murder that occurred on December 10th. On December 10th, Mr. Dunn was murdered in North Omaha. Shots were heard by ShotSpotter. Cars arrived. Mr. Dunn was in the street dying. And in the street was a hat, Philadelphia Phillies hat. Unique because later Mr. Hill is photographed for purposes of the trial with a P on his neck tattoo, a Pittsburgh Pirate. Having been a fan since I was 4 years old, those two don't mesh at all.
does the cap have your client's DNA on it?
One of two people. One of two major contributors. The other major contributor never identified. And it does have his DNA on it. The cap is tested. The gun is tested, and it has three contributors. I didn't see anywhere in the record where the other DNAs in the gun were compared to the other DNA in the hat. If it was there, I missed it. But at that point, we have a murder on December 10th. No eyewitness. There's two people who witnessed something. One of them sees two black males running, what they think are black males, running from the scene with hoods on. The other sees one male running from the scene with a hoodie on over his head, so they can't identify him other than believing him to be black male. And that person is carrying a sack of some kind. Earlier, Mr. Dunn was in a liquor store a few blocks away and had purchased something in a white sack. Now, one of the persons who identified the sack said he wasn't sure what color it was. It was white. It may have been gray. The other one said that he believed it to be a white sack. What's interesting is on direct examination and trial, both eyewitnesses indicated the hoodies, but on direct examination, they were not asked whether there was a hat on either one of the hooded person's heads. Opened up on cross-examination by defense counsel at that time, she asked them both about hats being on the head. Both got to the point of saying, maybe. Neither one positively said that there was a hat on the head of either one of these fleas.
I'm sorry, when you're referring to neither one, you're referring to Randy Dunn and Raul Francis? Those two.
Francia, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Those were the two people who identified. Mr. Francia said one was running. Mr. Dunn said two.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Dunn's testimony was kind of pointed because he said, I didn't know whether they were running from being shot at or whether they were running because they did the shooting. He also said, I didn't see any weapons. Both, neither one said they saw any weapons. The victim is found near the area where the people were running from. It's interesting because in the prosecutorial misconduct argument, the one item raised by counsel was that at closing arguments, the prosecution made a statement that both saw a cap and that one of them testified that he saw the cap, he looked back, and the cap wasn't on the guy's head any longer.
Was an objection made?
An objection was properly made at that point.
And then what did the court say in responding to that?
The witnesses heard what they heard.
The witnesses will remember the evidence as they remember the evidence.
Yeah, I guess I was...
Is that consistent with that standard final instruction to the jury?
Do I think so? No.
How do you think it's inconsistent?
I guess you have to take it in context of then the prosecutor re-says the same thing next. He says it again right after that witnesses will remember what they remember. I think the admonishment, if if that's considered an admonishment of some kind, the admonishment should have been much stronger. That is the whole key to this case. You have a cap with DNA found in December at a crime scene, a gun found under the seat of a car in February, 3 months later, and what ties anybody to this murder is the cap. To be able to mislead the jury like that, in my opinion.
Do you think it was a deliberate misleading events?
That's an interesting statement. I know the prosecutor well. I don't think so. I think it was a gross misstatement of the fact. But was it deliberate? I don't believe so. The gross misstatement is, it's, in my opinion, the only thing that ties those two events and the DNA found at those two events together.
What about the spent cartridge or the spent bullet that was found on the victim? Doesn't that match the gun?
Absolutely. The thing you have to remember there is it matches the gun to the murder, but we have two people's DNA on the hat and two to three people's DNA on the gun. I've handled too many cases, murder cases in Omaha. Guns get passed around like candy. And once there's a murder on a gun, it usually goes to somebody else. That's how they turn a murder on a gun. There's three people's DNA on that gun. We don't have anybody, even the identifications of the guys fleeing. Now, my client didn't testify and a record was not made about his size at the time. And that's pretty poignant in this case. But there was care to bring out that the people fleeing were skinny, appeared to be skinny individuals. The first witness, the guy in the school van, indicated that they were about my height, maybe an inch or two taller. He was 5'7", 5'9". My client, I'm not sure the record clearly reflects, is over six foot or over and weighed about 210 pounds at the time. So we have two individuals that don't match the build of the defendant, also seen fleeing the area. All of that together, and then you throw the statement by the prosecutor at the end, the witnesses will remember what they will remember.
Isn't it the jurors will remember?
The jurors, I'm sorry. And the last thing they will remember, the prosecutor making that statement. It's not evidence. We know it's not evidence.
And the jury was instructed. They'll
be instructed. And that's a little difficult to deal with, I understand, but I believe the misconduct in that situation, while not developed well in the brief, is so overwhelming. And then you top that with there's no motion for a mistrial. No motion after trial for new trial, which both could have been made in that situation. I'm not saying they would have been successful at the trial level, but they were probably examples of ineffective assistance in this case. The DNA, when you go into the DNA situation, apparently the state did not, or I mean the defense did not even seek an expert of their own on the particular. particular case. There's no indication, in my opinion, from the cross-examination that it was aided by an expert. And you can tell at one point the DNA person who's testifying for the state says something to the effect that didn't you listen to my answer? Can't you under when being cross-examined says didn't you listen to my answer? This is a DNA is something that most of us don't understand. And it's certainly in this case where you have mixtures and predominances, it certainly needs to be explained to the jury and it wasn't proper. With that, I will submit my further written argument.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You will have 5 days to respond to whatever Mr. Pivovar may supplement his brief with.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. I think the first issue I'd like to address is that the trial court erred in allowing the state to argue evidence of the hat showed that Hill was present at the scene. I would note that this is not assigned presently as prosecutorial misconduct. It's assigned as trial court error. Assignment of error is that the district court erred in allowing the state to argue that a witness saw or somebody with a hat at running from the scene and then they saw them later without the hat. That actually is not what the testimony reflects. The testimony at trial was I called them Raul and Randy because I can't remember their last names, but from Raul and Randy was that they saw somebody in a hoodie running at the scene. Both thought one of the people was wearing a hat. I think it was Randy Nunn said that he thought it was a ball cap. And moments later, when police and rescue personnel arrived at the scene where Virgil Dunn had been shot, there was a ball cap indeed found at the scene. No witness ever actually said that they saw the hat come off of one of the runners, but common sense is going to inform any juror that if somebody says, I saw somebody running wearing a ball cap at the scene and then a ball cap is found at the scene, it's a pretty good bet that that ball cap came from the person who was seen running with the ball cap. No one ever identified the defendant as being the person there at the scene. They simply said there was a ball cap found there in the DNA testing. Later performed on that ball cap, I came back with results that there were mixed contributors, two people on the ball cap, but the DNA, they swabbed two areas of the ball cap. Both came back with T. on Hill's DNA on it with fairly astounding results. One is one in 1.94 quadrillion for African Americans, and the other was one in 391 quintillion for African Americans, meaning that's T. on Hill's DNA on that. The district court said the jurors will remember the evidence as they remember the evidence.
So is your argument that the prosecutor really didn't inaccurately state the evidence, or what is your argument here?
It was a misstatement of the evidence, but in that the witnesses didn't actually testify, I saw the hat fly off his head. But if you take it by logical steps, it's a logical inference that if somebody is running there with a ball cap and moments later a ball cap is found there, it's a perfectly logical inference that that ball cap came from the person who was running from the scene there, because there simply wasn't time for anyone else to get there and drop a ball cap.
So how serious was his error?
I think it's de minimis. It isn't going to affect the outcome, I don't think, because it's a logical inference based on the facts as they presented themselves. There wasn't anybody else. By the time, the gunshots rang out and Virgil Dunn was shot down, and the time that the police or rescue personnel got there was just a matter of a very few minutes. And the people in the area didn't report seeing anybody else arrive at the scene where Virgil Dunn was lying on the ground until personnel, you know, rescue and police personnel showed up there. So the inference is that the hat had to have come from one of the people running there because there wasn't anybody else there to drop a ball cap there that just happened to have the defendant's DNA on it.
I think you started this part of your argument by saying that this was assigned as judge error, trial error,
correct,
and not prosecutorial misconduct. What difference does that make?
Well, I think it makes a difference in that you have to analyze it differently. It's not because it's not assigned as prosecutorial misconduct, you can't basically drop the dime on the state's feet and simply say, well, the state erred in doing this, and therefore we have error. You have to go back and look at whether or not what the trial court did when this was, when the state made this comment, and look at whether what the trial court did was correct or incorrect. This kind of segues into the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, because it was in rebuttal closing argument, and an objection was made and a motion to strike, at which the district court overruled. And the question then becomes whether that was correct or incorrect, not actually what the state did was correct or incorrect. It factors, what the state did factors into it, but it's a different analysis, basically. And that was at the point where the district court said, you know, the jury will remember the evidence as they remember the evidence. And if the jury was paying attention, they would know that that is technically an incorrect statement of what the evidence showed, but it's a logical inference to be drawn from it. And it's certainly not a leap of anyone's, you know, imagination to say that that would be the case. If there's somebody seen with a ball cap running in the area and a ball cap is later, you know, moments later found there, it is a perfectly logical inference that that came from somebody who was running from the area from where the gunshots were found and where the shooting victim was found. He argues that a mistrial on the ineffective assistance of counsel, the mistrial, motion for mistrial should have been made, but it wouldn't have been granted because the district court overruled the essentially lesser remedies of the objection and the motion to strike. And a mistrial is essentially the nuclear option when all other options have failed and there is nothing else that will cure the ill. Then you go for the mistrial, and the district court didn't feel that anything in this particular case was necessary because it overruled the motions for the objection and for the motion to strike. So on the ineffective assistance, the counsel claimed if counsel isn't ineffective for not making a motion that would not have been granted anyway, so I think we can resolve at least the issue of the ineffective assistance of counsel by saying it simply wouldn't have been granted under these circumstances. Your Honor, there are several other errors assigned. I think we have adequately addressed those in our brief. If you have questions, I will, of course, be happy to answer any of those. If there are none, then we would ask that, subject to additional briefing, that thus far the ruling of the district court and the judgment and convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Pivovar, thank you for your service in this matter. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is State